On July 14, 1965, Alice Crimmins slept in late, an unusual occurrence since she had two young children who usually woke her up. It was 9 a.m., and the home was void of the usual noise that always seems to follow children wherever they go. Alice opened the door to the bedroom that 5-year-old Eddie Jr. and 4-year-old Alice Jr. shared, only to find, to her horror, that their beds were empty and the screen to their open window was missing. What follows is the story of the original most hated woman in America. Alice's children would be found dead soon after. The case built up to convict Alice of their deaths was largely circumstantial. Some say that she was presumed guilty in the eyes of the police and the press because, at the time, she was living an unconventional lifestyle. The question remains, did Alice Crimmins kill her children or did the actual killer get away with murder? Tonight, in episode 60, I'll present the facts and leave it for you all to decide.
Hello, and welcome back to the 3 a.m. Mystery Club podcast. I'm Brandon.
I'm Ro.
And I'm Derek.
So as you heard from the intro, it's Ro's turn again tonight, and I think she's ready to go.
That's right. I'm ready to bring you all the murder and scandal that follows Alice Crimmins. So we begin with Alice Crimmins was born Mary Alice Burke in the Bronx, New York, on March 9th, 1939, to very strict Roman Catholic parents. At the age of 19, she married her high school sweetheart, Edmund Crimmins. Eddie was a mechanic for a nearby airline, and the couple moved to a middle-class neighborhood in Queens known as Kew Gardens. The apartment was ground floor with a garden view. And when I say this, just to set up the scene here, when I say middle class in the 1960s, that was like Mad Men's, Betty and Dawn out in the suburbs kind of thing. Like they had an apartment, but this was in Queens, New York. Everybody has an apartment. So they were actually, they lived, even though it was a good middle class lifestyle. So that's kind of important because the people they rolled around with and their extracurricular activities will come into play. And so when you think an apartment and an airline mechanic, you're like, wait, that doesn't add up in today's kind of lifestyle. But back then, that was a really good lifestyle for them. So just to clarify that.
Well, I have an apartment too. So there.
Well, like they also had like country club memberships and things like that. So just so people who don't maybe aren't familiar with New York City and the lifestyle there, that's just to kind of clarify for them. So anyway, Alice quickly became unhappy in the role of 1960s housewife. Edmund, or Eddie Sr., as I'll probably refer to him throughout this, worked very long hours and spent his time off drinking and carousing with his buddies, leaving Alice alone with the children for the majority of the time. In the 1960s, women's lib was experiencing a sort of second wave, especially with the better access to forms of birth control and the invention of the pill, which was like a godsend for women like Alice. Alice began discreetly having affairs, which led to Edmund discovering her diaphragm. This discovery enraged Edmund, who was a traditional Catholic, and it seems like he was almost more outraged by the fact that she didn't want more children than by the fact that she was having affairs. So Alice using birth control and not wanting more children was a direct attack on his family values, and it seemed to bother him a lot more than the adultery. In 1964, the couple formally separated, and Eddie moved into an apartment nearby. Alice embraced the single life. She obtained a job as a cocktail waitress. And with her movie star good looks and bright red bouffant hair, she was very popular. In February of 1964, Alice went on a trip with her main boyfriend, whose name was Anthony Grace. He was a middle-aged millionaire and also rumored to have had ties to the mafia. This seemed to have incensed Eddie and caused him to file for full custody of both children. Alice continued to work and play and, by all accounts, care for the children through all of this. We're going to skip forward a few months to July. It's summertime in New York City and air conditioning isn't a thing yet. However, in the main part of their apartment, I've seen in a couple accounts, they actually did have air conditioning. So good for her. but I guess maybe in the children's room, they didn't, because she always left the window open at night to let that cool air in. So on July 13th, according to Alice's statements, Alice took Eddie Jr. and Missy, which is what Alice Jr.'s nickname was, as her on an afternoon picnic at the park. Then they stopped at a deli to pick up veal for dinner. At home, she prepared dinner and put the kids to bed at around 9 p.m. At midnight, she checked in on them and helped Eddie Jr. to the bathroom. The next morning, on July 14th, Alice awoke late in the morning at 9 a.m. She quickly dressed and went to check on the children, and to her horror, their beds were empty and the window, which was open to let in the cool air, was missing its screen. Alice immediately called the children's father, her estranged husband, Eddie Sr. When he answered, she screamed, "Have you got the kids? Eddie, don't fool around. Do you have them? Please don't do this to me. Eddie, they're missing." Eddie came over and they called the police. Detective Gerard Peering, a veteran police officer with strict Catholic values, and I keep saying this not as an attack on religion, but to kind of set the tone for the types of people that were involved in this investigation, who maybe let their personal beliefs cloud their thinking. And as I go on with this case presentation, you'll see why. So Detective Gerard Peering, a veteran police officer with strict traditional Catholic values, was the first to respond. Upon seeing Alice at the door, already dressed up with her hair and makeup done, he formed an opinion. He noted with disdain that she didn't look like a mother whose children were missing, but instead a woman just carrying on with her everyday life. His initial sweep of the house included notes about how dusty the house was and that there were alcohol bottles in the trash. He also noted that Alice had a contact book filled with men's phone numbers and love letters from admirers and boyfriends. To further the tone of how this investigation was going to proceed, Peering told his partner to separate Alice and Eddie for questioning, saying, quote, "You take Eddie and I'll take the bitch," end quote. Alice's detailed account of the events leading up to the children's disappearance is as follows. They went for a picnic and returned home at 4:30 p.m. on July 13th. Alice called her lawyer regarding the custody hearing and a few other issues. And one of those issues was a former maid who previously looked after the children claimed she was owed $600 in back pay and would testify against Alice in the custody hearing if she wasn't paid. She then took the children with her to the deli and bought veal, soda, and a can of beans, prepared dinner, called her lawyer one more time. And then later she went for an evening drive with the children to see if Eddie was home. Now, this is why she wanted to know where Eddie was. Since the separation, he'd been stalking her. He would follow her around and park his car outside the apartment and watch who came and went. Sometimes he would become so angry that he would actually break in and scare off visitors. Also, unknown to Alice, Eddie Sr. had bugged the bedroom and was recording and listening to her as she entertained her boyfriends. After trying to locate Eddie Sr., Alice then returned home, bathed the children, and put them to bed. She noticed the window screen had a hole in it and replaced it with an older one. At 8:30 p.m., the children said their prayers, which was later confirmed by a neighbor who overheard them as she was walking outside. Once the children were in bed, Alice called Tony Grace, one of the men she'd been seeing. That was the guy that she'd went on the trip with earlier. She later received a call from Joe Rorick, a married father of seven, who was also in a relationship with her. He invited Alice out, but she declined. At midnight, Alice took Eddie Jr. to the bathroom and tucked him back into bed. She says she can't remember if she locked them in after that. Now, when asked why she locked her children inside their bedroom at night, Alice explained that Eddie Jr. often woke up in the middle of the night and would eat everything in the refrigerator. Just as a little sidebar there, as someone with children, I don't know that I would go to the extreme of locking them in the bedroom, but there is a worry that they will get up and wander around at night. I didn't really have much of a problem with that. So to me, the thought of locking them inside their bedroom is not only a fire hazard, but a little extreme. So I would be curious to hear if other people have ever heard of this or how they combated with their little roaming toddlers. So at around 1 a.m., she took her dog for a walk. Alice says she then fell asleep, but woke up around 2:45. To a noise, but wasn't concerned. Eddie then called around 3 a.m. to yell at her about the upcoming custody battle. Alice took the dog for another walk and went to bed around 3:30 a.m. That is quite a day. Now, Eddie was also questioned, and he gave a detailed statement to Detective Peering's partner, Detective George Martin, not the writer. Don't think they're related. His evening went as follows. He played golf and then drank at the golf club. He then drove past Joe Rorick's house looking for Alice. He then went to a nearby bar and drank until last call, which for our international listeners, I don't know what it is around the world, but around here, it's around 2:30, 3 a.m. So around 3 a.m., he parked his car outside of Alice's apartment. Witnesses all say they recall Eddie sitting outside the apartment, but exactly where he was sitting differs. Some say he was outside the children's window, while others say he remained in his car. He then drove home and called Alice to discuss custody. I use the term discuss very lightly because no good calls ever happen at 3 a.m. unless you belong to the 3 a.m. Mystery Club. While being questioned, the home was processed for clues. However, the forensics wasn't as precise back then. Few photos were taken at the crime scene, and fingerprints weren't taken from the windowsill where the screen went missing. And the children were presumed to have left the house through the windowsill. But nobody bothered to take fingerprints in that area, which baffles me because in our other cases, we know as early as the early 1900s, they were doing fingerprints. So that should be standard practice at this point. Hours after the police were called in, the body of 4-year-old Missy was located in a vacant lot. Now, Detective Peering, and I'm going to be totally biased in this because it's my case and, you know, we're not journalists. To me, he is a complete asshole. towards Atlas. And what he does next really just irritated me beyond. So little Missy's body was found. And instead of informing Atlas that, hey, unfortunately, we think we found your daughter, we need you or your husband to come and identify the body. No, he didn't. He just grabbed Alice and told her, come with us. He didn't tell her why she needed to come. She just assumed maybe they were going down to the precinct for some more questioning or something like that. Put her in the police car, didn't tell her where they were going. They pulled up to a vacant lot full of police officers and press. He silently escorted her to a sheet-covered body and without warning, pulled the sheet up and asked Alice, is this your daughter? Alice was so taken aback that she actually fainted. Later, when they went to drop her back off, she saw that a bunch of reporters were also waiting at her home and ambushed her, and she began to cry and she ran into her home. Now, to Detective Peering, he did not think this was genuine emotion. He said that on the stand later in court, he said that she did not react to her daughter's death at all. So basically, he lied on the stand after. There were multiple witnesses that said Alice fainted at the shock of seeing her daughter and that she ran crying into her home. He then backs it up by saying, I think she was just acting for the cameras.
So wait, Alice is innocent?
It's up for debate. And as we get into it, you'll be able to decide what you think. I personally have my own opinions, and I'm pretty sure you can tell what my opinions are with my tone.
Okay, I just jumped the gun there.
Yeah, no, it is coming. Don't worry, it's coming. And like I said, it's up for debate still. But if you haven't figured out my opinion by now, you will by the end of this, I'm sure. So Missy's autopsy would reveal that she died from asphyxiation or strangulation, but was not beaten or sexually assaulted. The contents of her stomach showed that she had eaten not veal as her last meal, but macaroni and vegetables, which caused Detective Peering to accuse Alice of lying even about her daughter's last meal. An exact time of death could not be determined, and medical examiners gave investigators a window for her time of death between 10 p.m. and 4 a.m. 5 days later, Eddie Jr.'s body was found. So his cause of death was undetermined, but it was likely that he was killed at the same time as Missy. Initially, no suspects were officially identified by the police. Alice and Eddie Sr. briefly got back together and were being secretly surveilled by the police. The surveillance and recordings on the phone wiretap showed that Alice was still continuing to date other men, while Eddie had developed an obsession with the details of his children's deaths. He seemed obsessed with keeping up with the investigation. Eddie and Alice were both asked to take lie detector tests. The day before he was due to take his test, Eddie visited the library. He spent an entire day reading books on guess what?
What?
How to pass a polygraph test.
That's not convenient or anything.
No. What is that on TikTok? That's suspicious. So then apparently he was a great study because he passed his polygraph test. Alice also took a polygraph test, but it was inconclusive. during her test, she answered all the questions, got to the last question, and as she was getting ready to answer it, she claims that she looked up and saw shadows, like a group of men, but it was like shadowy, and heard them laughing and snickering at her, and then she saw them light up cigarettes. So it made her mad, and she, maybe not the best judgment, ripped off all the equipment and stormed out of the police station. So while I can understand why she was angry, probably not a good look when you're a big suspect in a case. Okay, so Alice and Eddie broke up again, and wiretaps of Alice's phone revealed that she was now receiving harassing phone calls and that the voice was similar to Eddie. Surveillance also found that Eddie had exposed himself to children playing in a nearby park. But nothing was done about that, and he was cleared as a suspect. Detective Peering, who is still the lead detective, continued his surveillance of Alice, and it could be safe to say that it bordered on harassment. So now at this time, Alice is no longer a cocktail waitress. She is being tailed by the police. She is tabloid fodder. Like, she is, every day they're coming up with a new tabloid about her. She is just, she sells papers. So she is looking for other employment. She begins to apply for quieter, more private jobs, like as a secretary. And she's doing it under her maiden name. Well, because the police are surveilling her, they know this. And as soon as she gets a new job, Detective Peering or other detectives will actually go in to wherever she's working and say, hey, we think this woman killed her kids. You shouldn't let her work for you. And then she would be fired the next day, which I feel like is probably illegal now. So her bedroom and phones were still bugged and tapped with recording devices. And her sometimes boyfriend, Joe Rorick, was approached by police and blackmailed into wearing a recording device. Now, police had discovered that Joe was bisexual, and when he wasn't cheating on his wife with Alice, he was dating a drag queen. I didn't get any more details on this drag queen's name or anything like that, but it was on the episode of A Crime to Remember, is where I got that little tidbit, and that'll be in our show notes if you want to watch that later. But
maybe it was Lady Bunny.
Could have been. I mean, but needless to say, Joe was forced into compliance for fear he would go to jail himself, because in the 60s, homosexuality was still illegal. As we know, Stonewall is coming up pretty close after this. So this was a pretty volatile time and a pretty dangerous time to be gay. Especially in New York, it seemed like the Vice Squad was really cracking down on gay men at that time. So needless to say, Joe was scared and he was forced to wear a wire and basically spy on his girlfriend. In addition to the bugs and wires, police followed Alice and parked outside her home day and night. After 3 years of this, the district attorney began the process of shutting down the investigation. The authorities had no evidence against Alice. And even with all these private recordings that her boyfriend Joe was doing, he was forced into recording her because they'd found out he'd been dating Lady Bunny.
That Lady Bunny has been around for a while.
It pays to be an old drag queen for sure. So, but they had nothing. Alice never once, even when Joe would try to lead her into saying something to make her guilty. She never fell for it. She never suspected him of any of this. She never did anything to implicate herself in a crime. And then we know Eddie was cleared because he cheated on that polygraph test and passed. So in a last ditch effort, Detective Peering had officers sort of go through their anonymous tip line, which back then it was, they had received more letters than phone calls. So he had them go through the mail one more time. And miraculously, an anonymous letter was found stating that an eyewitness had seen a dark-haired woman with her husband and children in tow. This tipster was later identified as Sophie Iromirsky, a local woman known for telling embellished stories and outright lying. She would be, right. Yeah. We all have someone like that in our neighborhood. She would be a key witness in court. The medical examiner also, as this case was getting shut down, amended Missy's time of death to say that it occurred before midnight. With this new witness and the amended report, Alice Crimmins was arrested and brought to court in 1968. As a result, the tabloids caught fire once again with headlines about Alice the sexpot, the seductress, the manhunter, the Medea of Kew Gardens. And I don't mean Medea as in Tyler Perry, but they were referring to the Greek Medea who killed her children. I don't remember the myth, but I do know she killed her children. So that's what they were referring to. The jury on the trial were all white men with stern faces and disapproving scowls. They could actually probably have been Detective Peering's cousins, according to different reports I read online about this. Like, they just all looked the same. While the evidence was circumstantial, the defense still had a flimsy case. Made worse still when they put Alice herself on the stand. The prosecution asked what would end up being one of the most damning questions in the trial. And as follows, this is a transcript. They were questioning Alice on her activities with Joe Rorick, and here's how it went. Question, does he have swimming pools there, Miss Crimmins? To which she answered, yes. Question, do you ever go swimming in that pool? Alice answers, yes, I did. Question, what were you wearing when you were swimming in that pool? Alice answers, one time a bathing suit, one time no bathing suit. Question, where were your children when you went swimming without a bathing suit in Joe Rorick's pool, Mrs. Crimmins? Alice answers, they were dead. So it's not looking good for Alice here. Joe Rorick, still under police pressure, testified against Alice as well. The particular testimony he gives was coincidentally the only time his recording device hadn't been on him. Surprise, surprise. He testified that Alice had said that things would have been different if he'd come over the night the children went missing. Now, if you remember at the beginning of this case report, Alice's police statement said that night that Joe invited her out and she declined. He's implying that she invited him to come over. So one of them is lying. Alice stood up in the courtroom and screamed at Joe on the stand. Joseph, how could you do this? This isn't true. Joseph, you of all people. Oh my God. Alice Crimmins was found guilty of first degree manslaughter. The jury said that the proof from the medical examiner's time of death is what swayed them. They didn't know about the time of death change prior to the trial. She was sentenced to quote, more than 5 years, but less than 20, end quote. In 1969, Alice was granted an appeal because three jurors in the first trial had actually went and visited Kew Gardens to investigate and view the area on their own, which isn't allowed when you're in a jury. You're supposed to be sequestered and not following the trial outside of what you hear in the courtroom. At the appeal trial, she would now be on the hook for both children's deaths, as the medical examiner now stated that Eddie Jr.'s cause of death could be inferred to be similar to his sister's. Now, inferred is a guess. It's not a fact. It's not tangible proof. This time, Alice was convicted of the manslaughter of her daughter and the murder of her son. Alice spent years in and out of appeals court. Eventually, the conviction was overturned because actual cause of death on Eddie Jr. couldn't factually be determined. And the prosecutor in the second trial had made inflammatory remarks about Alice. So in the second trial, when she was being tried for both children now at this time, the new prosecutor would goad Alice and taunt her and try to get her to make outbursts like she had at the first trial. And her new lawyers knew not to take this bait, and they wouldn't let her testify on her behalf because they saw how she was on the stand. And the prosecuting attorney actually faced the jury and said something to the effect of, "You see, she is so guilty that she can't even speak on her own behalf because she knows she'll crack." And so the Court of Appeals was like, "Oh no, you can't be, that's against the law. You can't, that's swaying the jury. That's inflammatory." So the prosecution, so her conviction of the murder of her son was overturned, and she was set free for a little bit. But in 1975, she was sent back to prison because while the murder conviction on Eddie Jr. was overturned, the manslaughter conviction on her daughter was to be upheld. So from 1975 to 1977, she was in jail. During that time in 1977, she remarried, and the person she married was her first boyfriend after her divorce from Eddie, the millionaire, possible mobster, Anthony Grace. Upon Alice's release, they moved to Key Largo, Florida. They spent their golden years, as you would say, on a yacht that he had named after Alice. He died in 1998. Alice is in her 80s now, and at last check, because she's so reclusive, she's hard to keep tabs on. She was still alive as of June, which was the most recent report or article I read on her. She was still alive. She lives very quiet and very privately, as you can imagine she would. And that is the story of Alice Crimmins. It is, while she was convicted in a court of law, a lot of people who go back and look at this case don't think that she did this. A lot of people are looking towards Eddie Sr. for this. So I'm curious to know what you guys think.
Well, my first thought is, did they do it together? Or I know she was paroled and all of that, but I don't understand why it would necessarily have to be one or the other, since they were seemingly pretty tight.
Yeah, and that's, some people have speculated that too, that it could have been both of them. Whether it was an accident that they died and then she called him to help get rid of the bodies, or that they both did it. There's a popular opinion that 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 could have happened?
I feel like, I mean, even if she didn't do it, it almost seems like she would know something about it. I don't know why.
Yeah, like maybe she knew a lot more than she was telling.
And I also, I don't know why, but I find it really crazy personally that she's still living. I mean, clearly there are a lot of people still living from that time. I don't know why it's blowing my mind so much, but she's still living. And if Wikipedia is correct, it looks like she's married.
Yeah, she married that Tony Grace. Like, she stayed married to him until he died.
The pictures and your description of her kind of reminds me of, I don't remember which girl's mom it was, but the mom in that movie Now and Then, where she wears the go-go boots and gets out of the car.
Oh, yeah.
She's reminded me of.
Oh, was it Melanie Griffith's character's mom, wasn't it?
I think it was.
Yeah. But no, and she was. And the tabloid headlines would kind of, they were kind of remind you of more modern day headlines. They would say like sex pot mom or bombshell mommy and things like that. And it just, I'm sure you can imagine.
Grace going.
I'm sure you can imagine who that reminds us all of.
Sex pot moms, bombshell mommies.
I mean, this was right up Nancy Grace's, you know, alley. Like, if there were, I want to know who the 1960s version of Nancy Grace would have been. Would it have been, what's his name? Walter Winchell?
Walter Cronkite or somebody.
Yeah, right.
Definitely an old white guy.
That would have just the evening news every night. Walter Cronkite, bombshell mom.
Tonight we're going to talk about Alice Crimmins, also known as Sex Pot Mom.
Oh, I just need you to just do all of our cases in Nancy Grace voice now.
Yeah.
Unleash the lawyers.
I don't know if I think she's innocent or not, but I think that there was not, you know, enough evidence or anything like that. So I definitely think she was put on trial for her sexuality, you know, being a sex pot mom. And I think even convicted for that reason.
Yeah. And I agree. Like, I can't decide whether she did it or not, or like Derek said, whether she just knew a lot more than she let on. But I do think there was not enough evidence to bring her to trial and convict her. I mean, if that's all they had on her, they should have brought Eddie to trial too. They had more on him than they did her.
Right, exactly.
But yeah, so that is the case of Alice Crimmins. I hope you all liked it. It was set in the 60s, which is one of our favorite timelines around here.
And you have to show in the show notes, you have to put the picture of, speaking of Nancy Grace, you have to put the side-by-side picture of Alice Crimmins and Casey Anthony.
Yes, I will. And that is another thing. Alice Crimmins, they say, has sort of set the precedence for how maternal murderers are portrayed in the media. You have... Susan Smith gets brought up a lot. And then more recently, Casey Anthony gets compared to her a lot. I don't like comparing her to Casey Anthony, though, because this is just my opinion. So, you know, if you have a problem with it, you can come at me. I'm comfortable with that. In my opinion, Casey Anthony did it. Whereas, like no question, she did it. Whereas with, Alice, we don't know. Like 100, like I am, this is one of those cases where I truly don't know if she did it or not. I kind of get upset when people are like, she just set the precedence. She's like Casey Anthony. Like, no.
Yeah, I don't know if she did it. I don't know if she did it either. I'm really torn on that.
Yeah, and that's kind of why I like this case, because a lot of times you'll get these old cases And you look back on the evidence and, you know, like looking at it with your modern viewpoint and what we know about forensics and cold cases now, you usually, within the first 10 minutes of reading something, you know whether they did it or not. And this one still will keep you guessing.
Well, it was a good one. And once again, one I hadn't heard of.
Yay. And if you like this and you want to know more about Alice, the Investigation Discovery show, A Crime to Remember, which is a Mystery Club favorite. I think we all find cases from there from time to time, is where I got most of my case information. So you can actually watch the episode. It's going to be in my citation notes anyway, so you can click on the link and watch it. It's got that. It also has the Career Girl murders, which Brandon covered and is also a fan favorite.
Oh, yeah. I actually watched that that episode, which is, I think that episode is when I first decided to do the case. I was like, okay, yeah, because I knew about the case for a long time, but then I was like, I didn't know if there'd be enough meat to it. But then when I watched that, I was like, okay, I can do it.
You know, I will say, I watched that again because it came on right after Alice's episode, and I will never use Noxzema again, ever. So if you want to know more about this case, you can check out our source notes. You can join us on our Facebook group where you can see extra bonus content and pictures. You can follow us on Instagram if you're just interested in looking at the pictures that go along with this case. And as always, we're on Twitter. So check us out.